Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are at the campus of Carleton University, where I come only when there's a very special occasion. And today we have a special occasion, as Senate reform continues to be a hot topic in this city, and I think around the country as well, and it's been buoyed in recent months with Justin Trudeau kicking out the Liberal senators from the caucus, and then recently the surprising decision of Conservative senators not to support fully the Elections Act, the new Elections Act. So the issue has come up again, so we're here talking to an expert on the Canadian Senate and Senate reform, James McHugh from Akron University, and he is here at Carleton as the 2014 Fulbright Visiting Research Chair in North American Integration. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, we just talked about this, but if you could just touch on, you're an American from Vermont mm-hmm. who works at Akron, and you study the Canadian political system.
Right. I'm currently at Akron. I've also been at Roosevelt University in Chicago, at American University in Washington, D.C., and I got my start teaching, actually, while I was a graduate student at Queen's University. And I was fortunate in Vermont. I went to the University of Vermont as an undergraduate, where at the time there was a very strong Canadian studies program. And, you know, given the proximity to Canada, growing up an hour and a half from Montreal, mm-hmm. you know, growing up with the Montreal Expos, having a mother whose ancestry was French-Canadian, etc., there was certainly already some elements there to attract me to the study of Canada. But clearly, by the time I was at UVM, there was a, I developed a great deal of interest. And when I went to graduate school at the University of Edinburgh, not intending to study Canada there, it turns out I was studying British Imperial History at that point, and my thesis supervisor just happened to be the director of the Center for Canadian Studies at Edinburgh. And by the time I got done there, I was really hooked on wanting to continue my study of Canada. So I went back to my undergraduate major of political science and enrolled at Queen's for the PhD program.
And then down in the United States, different places, and now you're up here at Carleton.
Yep.
Which I'm sure the people here are very excited, and I know I'm excited that you're here. So
It's been a great, great time up here. Yeah.
So. Yeah. So what have you been working on? Have you been working primarily on issues of Senate while you've been here?
No, that's actually something I had hoped was going to be wrapped up before I came here, but I ended up I'm working on a book, and I needed to do revisions, so I spent a good deal of time on that, but I've also been working on a book on a hypothetical Charter of Rights for North America. And the real purpose of it is not so much the Charter of Rights, but the way in which it highlights the development of a regional identity in North America, just as South America and Africa have developed a sense of regional identity and regional association in a global, increasingly unipolar world. Right. And so I explore some of the themes about what really does bring Canada, Mexico, and the United States together, if at all, as a continent. Is there really a sense of a North American identity? And the answer is, kind of, but it's growing. But there is a growing convergence of values among those three countries.
Okay. Interesting. So the bulk of what you were doing before you got here, and I guess since you've been here, you've written a couple op-eds that I've seen about the Senate. So before we talk about reforming the Senate, let's try to nail down exactly what it is and what is its purpose as designed in a parliamentary democracy. What is the purpose of the Senate in the Canadian context?
That's a great question, because many people mistake the role of the upper house in a parliamentary system for the role of the upper house in a republic.
Right.
In a republican system of government, it's a very different kind of animal. It is intent. Now, one thing that they have in common is that upper houses, whether they're in republics or in parliamentary systems, are intended to reflect a constituency that's distinct from the lower house. And in a democracy, the lower house represents, you know, the people, representation by population. So typically the upper house represents something else. And that something else can vary from country to country. So that's a constant. But in a republic, it's expected to have co-equal powers, because republics are designed to be inefficient.
Okay.
They're designed for what's called non-responsible government. In other words, the administration does not rise or fall on the basis of whether it can get its platform through, whether it can get its policies adopted, as opposed to a parliamentary system where if you can't get your policies adopted, your government falls and you're replaced or you call new elections.
Right.
So for the Senate of Canada, there is this expectation that its role is supposed to be more limited, more specialized, and it is not expected to mirror what the House of Commons does, even though procedurally it goes through the exact same steps that the House of Commons does in the process of approving legislation.
So is it just a rubber stamp? Because I think a lot of people view it in that way, in that the Commons passes a bill, it goes to the Senate, maybe they have a committee meeting on it, but basically they're just there to approve it and move it on.
In Britain, they have a parliamentary convention called the Salisbury Convention. And this was an agreement that was reached after World War II involving the upper house of the British Parliament, the House of Lords. And it was really based on practices that had already been in effect for a while. And the Salisbury Convention basically articulates that if a piece of legislation is part of an electoral mandate, then yes, the House of Lords should rubber stamp it. Mm-hmm. The House of Lords can, however, at the same time, offer improvements, amendments. It can make those suggestions and send them back down. If the House of Commons does not agree, however, then at that point, yes, rubber stamp. Mm-hmm. But if the government is going to introduce something that's not part of its electoral mandate, that's something entirely new, and particularly something that may be controversial or does not have public support, then it's more fair game for the upper house to oppose it in some way. Generally, it will not oppose it in terms of outright defeat, but it will often insist on certain amendments. And sometimes those amendments, the government will back down on that. A good example occurred in 1985. The government of Margaret Thatcher wanted to eliminate the Greater London Council and other local entities. The argument was that they wanted to decentralize. They wanted to break these things down into smaller units. This would be more democratic, and they argued it would be more efficient because these local governments were very inefficient. In fact, it had a lot more to do with the fact that these local government entities were controlled by the opposition party. They were a real thorn in the side of the government. And the government had no electoral mandate on this issue. This was not something the government ran on in any way. And public opinion seemed to be pretty strongly against this kind of reorganization. So the House of Lords actually threatened to defeat this legislation. The government was successful in mobilizing its peers and getting it through, but it was forced to accept four major amendments that later became the basis for the reintroduction after the Thatcher government fell of local government once again. So Ken Livingstone actually ended up returning as mayor of London decades later as a result of what the House of Lords had done. It was rather ironic because as a member of the Labour Party, he had been very much opposed to the House of Lords in principle, and yet the House of Lords was very instrumental in helping him come back into power.
Now, you mentioned the bill that goes that isn't part of a government's mandate. How is the government's mandate identified? Is that from the speech from the throne? Is that why that's done in the Senate or in the House of Lords as opposed to in the Commons?
Well, the speech from the throne ought to reflect what the party in power said during the election.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't always do that,
right,
but it ought to. And I think there's a sense, and this is one of the things that people in Canada are starting to forget about their parliamentary system. In a Westminster model, there's a sense that you don't have to write the rules down, that people sort of understand the rules. They understand what, you know, what is and what is not done. And so I think there's a common acceptance that if a government really didn't run on a particular issue, well, fine, the government can introduce that issue, but this is not what the people voted for. Therefore, it can be subject to much more scrutiny.
Right. So is that sort of like, so let's say the Free Elections Act and the way the conservative senators are saying no to certain elements of that right now, is that a reflection of that? I mean, that wasn't part of their mandate.
It wasn't. Furthermore, there's a lot of public opposition right now to it. And there's a feeling that there's something that's not quite right about that. The upper house usually feels more empowered to do something when public opinion is with it.
Right, yeah.
And so that helps a lot. Whether or not they will ultimately stop the government on that issue, again, that often faces a question of if they do so, will this be considered an issue that could bring down the government?
Right.
And if it could, then they'll probably back down, because that's one thing that they don't feel that they are entitled to do, largely because they're unelected. Mm. And that makes a big difference. Now, the difference, say, in Australia is that elected senators feel less encumbered about bringing down the government because, hey, we have a mandate too.
Right. So would it be fair to say that it serves as a check on the Commons or more just oversight?
Oversight is a good way of putting it. I think, though, the members of the upper house often think of themselves as complementary in their role. Okay. Their role is to improve legislation, to give it a thorough going over. So, for example, the Canadian Senate has actually been very good. It has been often cited as being very good about catching technical mistakes in legislation that comes up from the House of Commons, or perceiving possible difficulties from a practical perspective in that legislation, and then offering improving amendments. So the Senate often sees itself as improving legislation rather than really getting involved in scrutinizing whether it's wise or not, or whether it ought to be. And most of its work is in that area. And I think that's typical for a lot of parliamentary upper houses.
Right. One of the things that I noticed, too, is that there seems to be a lot of Senate hearings or Senate committee meetings, and even on stuff that maybe not be related to legislation, just to maybe gather information or bring attention to a certain issue. And is that a large part of its function as well?
It is.
Information gathering service, almost?
Historically, that it has done that, and it has increased that role in recent years. But that has historically been a big part of its function. It often serves an ombuds function
right.
in that sense as well. It's a way for the public to gain additional access into the parliamentary process, to provide information and to express opinions, concerns, etc. A friend of mine who actually teaches here as an adjunct professor, Craig Jones, was the former executive director of the John Howard Society and was called to Parliament Hill for just that purpose, for a Senate hearing on minimum sentencing laws, and was asked, he said, well, you're an expert on this. You're a political scientist. You're head of this organization. What evidence is there? And he went through, just tons of evidence that basically concluded that there was no correlation between minimum sentencing laws and decreases in crime. That did not deter the government one iota. But it nonetheless helped to inform the public so that in the future the public may support changes in that legislation. It made the public more aware of the implications of that legislation that might not otherwise have occurred, because there is a superficial sense that mandatory sentencing is a get-tough-on-crime, common-sense issue. And what the Senate often does is challenge whether or not that common sense is right or not, at least to give the public more information on which to base its opinions.
Is it effective in doing so? Because I think a lot of people, and especially recently with all the scandals, the spending scandals that broke last summer, people look at the Senate and sort of roll their eyes a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the scandals didn't help, although frankly, if you look through parliamentary histories, the lower house is just as scandal-ridden as the upper house. And I think at least in a couple of cases in the Senate, those scandals were based more on a real problem of interpreting the way the rules should be applied and what does and does not qualify as a reasonable expense, etc. When you put it in the really big picture, the scandals should not have been a factor in determining whether or not the upper house is useful. But sadly for the Senate, it fed into a stereotype that here are a bunch of people who have essentially a sinecure. They're given a big, salary in order not to do very much, and it's a big gravy train. And even though that's, when you put it in perspective, that's not really what emerged from this, it feeds into stereotypes, I think, sometimes. And so that's unfortunate. Not to say that that wasn't a scandal, certainly, but I think its impression was exaggerated on the public. And one of my colleagues made a very interesting point about it. He said, well, if the current government really wanted to get rid of the Senate, what better way than to appoint people who are going to cause a scandal and make the public really angry about the upper house? So.
I've heard that theory before, and I love it so much, because if that was true, that's almost too brilliant for words.
I was going to say, that's like the old explanation of the new Coke thing.
Right.
He said, because when Coca-Cola brought back the old Coke, it made it more popular than ever.
Right.
And a lot of people said, boy, you couldn't have planned that more. Most people say, no, of course not. New Coke was a blunder. But it's the same kind of analogy. Yeah.
Now, speaking of these individuals who are senators, how exactly do they get appointed? I know, they're appointed by the government, and they're approved by the Governor General, but is there a criteria for who gets appointed? Is it supposed to be someone affiliated with the party in power in some capacity? Is it supposed to be a prominent person? How do we decide, or how does the government decide who they're going to appoint to the Senate?
This is one of the great weaknesses of the Senate. Constitutionally, the only requirements are they have to be at least 30 years of age, they have to And they have to have a certain amount of money, which is really a throwback to the mid-19th century expectation that members of the Senate would be property, much like the landed aristocracy of the House of Lords, which quickly became a non... I mean, they have to have, I think it was $44,000 of real income above and beyond. And there was actually a senator who was a nun who had taken a vow of poverty, who was appointed. And what happened was her order... actually on paper transferred some property into her name so that she would then be officially eligible to become a senator. But, you know, it has become something that is associated with patronage, and that has really hurt the Senate. And the fact that the, you know, there is a limited number of senators to begin with does undermine the perception of the Senate vis-a-vis other upper houses. Because there is, and the House of Lords is probably the best example, there are upper houses where people do get their appointments as a result of merit, as a result of popular, you know, acclaim, etc. One of the features of the House of Lords is the presence of what are called the crossbenches. And the crossbenches is where people who do not have a party affiliation sit. And there's a number of people who receive a peerage as a result of their act, you know, it is something automatically that happens for people in certain areas. For example, the governor of the Bank of England typically, when he retires, becomes a peer. But so too does the president of the Trades Union Congress. Mm. So, and these are people who are expected, even if they, one might have voted conservative, the other voted Labour, they are kind of expected to become crossbenchers. They're expected to represent a non-partisan perspective on certain issues. The Senate is lacking that component, and that's something that I think Justin Trudeau was trying to address by having Liberal senators removed from the caucus, not thrown out of the party, but removed from the caucus. Because again, that's very much the case in the British parliamentary system. The caucus for the parties in that system has members from the upper house, but only those members of the upper house were either government ministers or government critics, or occupy certain special roles or functions within the upper house. The vast majority of them do not sit as part of caucus.
Do you think having that party affiliation and having senators as part of the caucus weakens the Senate?
It doesn't necessarily weaken it, because certainly you can have those people who are active and devoted, and certainly people in public life are going to be particularly well suited for appointment. But if you don't have as well a good body of people who are appointed because of their distinguished service, because of merit, etc., then it becomes does become more of a problem.
So I guess this all leads into the singular question of, do we need to reform the Senate in Canada? Is it something that is necessary?
It is not absolutely necessary. The Canadian parliamentary system will function just fine with the Senate the way it is, and the Senate does perform a very useful role in the legislative process, in public interest, etc. But I do believe it would benefit from certain types of reform, particularly certain types of non-constitutional reform. Because I think constitutional reform is just something that's not achievable under the current political climate. But non-constitutional reforms, and much of those non-constitutional reforms would be very informal. They would be something along the line. That's the thing I liked about what Justin Trudeau did, is because he was showing an example of how you can do something that may have a positive effect on the way that the Senate functions without having to resort even to legislation, let alone constitution. And I know there are senators who've been talking about doing these sorts of internal reforms to make the Senate less partisan, to make it function more effectively, and to make the public more aware of its role in improving legislation, in providing a liaison between the public and the parliamentary system, and many of these other things. So I think that is something that ought to be done. I don't think it necessarily has to be done. I think the Senate does more than people realize, and it does it well. But it's then important to overcome some of these popular perceptions that we were discussing previously.
But if you're trying to take out partisanship, sure, I mean, you can have Justin Trudeau say to the Liberal senators, you're not in the caucus anymore. But at the same time, is it not incredibly difficult for whoever is in power, regardless of which party it is, to not appoint people who are favorable to them.
It is. And that's why you also have to, part of that non-constitutional reform ought to be some agreement on a sharing in that process. Again, what makes it difficult is because you have a set number of senators, you don't have as many opportunities for doing it. But if you look at the House of Lords, which has an open-ended membership, typically the government, for example, will appoint a number of peers in any given year, but the opposition parties are also allowed to nominate people who would typically be appointed as well. Furthermore, in Britain, they've adopted a new practice, which are called people's peers. It's literally an appointment authority where people nominate other people, usually nonpartisan people, to receive a peerage, to be eligible to sit in the House of Lords. And that has become fairly popular in recent years, and it's connected to the vetting process that exists in the House of Lords. The House of Lords has a committee that actually vets people who are being considered for peerages and considers whether or not that person really is worthy of such a distinction and makes a recommendation. Now, the recommendation can be rejected, but it puts a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister in terms of the recommendations that are ultimately made to the Queen.
One of your op-eds in The Citizen talked about how you believe this House of Lords style should be brought to Canada as a way to address these issues that you've talked about. And I guess one of the questions I would have about that is there's a lot of people in this country who would think that that's backsliding back to this imperial tradition that we've gotten away from. How would you address that?
That's really hard because you're right. The impression of the House of Lords traditionally is a bastion of aristocratic privilege. Now, it really hasn't been that way for a very long time, but obviously the title of Lord still conveys certain impressions. I remember I had a friend in graduate school who actually claimed that if they got rid of the House of Lords, the class system would be eliminated. It's like, kidding? I know. I mean, but it's this idea that it's all tied to this perpetuation of a certain class system, etc. And so that's why I consider that kind of reform to be radical, because it's so counterintuitive. And it requires looking a little deeper at what the House of Lords really does and how the reforms that have occurred within the House of Lords over the last century, which have been incremental reforms. That's one of the nice things about it. They've done it a bit at a time, and if something works, they stick with it, and if something doesn't work, they try something else, rather than the kind of whole cloth reform that has been often recommended, like the Triple E Senate, you know, which has so many unintentional consequences that it would really be a dangerous thing to try to reform it in that way. I think piecemeal reform is helpful, and in that case you can use some of the things that the House of Lords has done, such as the suspensive veto, whereupon you can delay legislation, but you cannot ultimately prevent it if the government really insists on it. Doing that really liberated the House of Lords, made it more active, made it more willing to challenge the government on certain things, because challenging the government didn't mean that the government was going to fall or that the government was not going to get its policy through. It simply meant that it was going to really force the government to defend more fully and to consider more fully the legislation that it was proposing.
Right. It's sort of the thing of that I say, even just about my own work, is that if I have like a month to go away from it and come back and look at it, it'll be improved because I've just had that time to think about it, right? So it's the same idea.
The House of Lords has defeated only a handful of government legislation in the past several decades. But what's interesting is it's extremely rare, and it's only been, I think, three times, that legislation that was defeated in the House of Lords was passed again over its objections. The way a suspensive veto works is the House of Commons passes something, the House of Lords defeats it, it's returned to the House of Commons. If the House of Commons, the next session, passes it again, and the House of Lords defeats it a second time, it automatically becomes a law.
Okay.
It is rare when the House of Lords does defeat something for that process to go all the way through. The House of Commons usually backs down at that point.
Okay.
And meaning the government backs down. And the reason is the House of Lords is very selective about what it defeats. It defeats legislation that is not part of a government's mandate, for which the public has some really deep concerns. And so when it goes back to the government says, okay, well, this is not politically worth it. Right. You know, this is hurting us. We have to and so they do think again. There is that sense of this is the chamber of sober second thought,
right? Which is something that, especially the way that again people view the system right now, is that if it gets through the Commons in Canada, then it's going to be a law, and that there isn't a chance to reflect on whether or not something is actually best.
The Senate very rarely ever defeats anything because its defeat is absolute. And so yeah. That's a huge, you know, I mean, if the Senate were to start doing that more often, then yes, there probably would be a lot more consensus for its abolition.
Now, one of the calls that has been made repeatedly in terms of Senate reform is electing them. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the case of Australia where that upper house is a little more emboldened to do things because mm-hmm. they have an elected mandate. And you mentioned the Republican system, how the two bodies can clash and really just stall the government and that nothing happens. My sense is that you don't think the elected Senate would work in a Canadian context.
No, I don't think it's a good idea for the very reason that you were intimating, that sovereign authority, the democratic sovereign authority for the federal government rests in the election of the House of Commons. So anything that can be set up in opposition to it does undermine the principle of parliamentary democracy. But when you give people an electoral mandate, it does give them a sense of empowerment. Oh, we represent the people too. Mm-hmm. And if we look to the United States, this is exactly the argument that's often raised. You know, people say, well, President Obama was reelected, but Republican senators say, well, so was I. And right. therefore, if I want to put a hold on this legislation, I can do so because the people are speaking through me as well. You want to avoid that situation with the parliamentary upper house because the parliamentary upper house has not evolved in a way that is supposed to make it this kind of counterweight to what the government does. One thing that does make people more supportive of the elected Senate is the idea that it could represent the interests of the provincial government.
Okay.
The problem with that is twofold. Number one, the system was not really designed for the provinces to interfere in that way. And secondly, and one of the models used for that is the Bundesrat in Germany, where the upper house of the German parliament actually consists of members of the Länder or state governments. So there is this sense that, you know, the state governments get actively involved in the legislative process at the federal level. Okay. That may work for Germany because it fits with Germany's political culture, and Germany does not have a Westminster model system, so it's a little different than the system that Canada inherited from Britain. But to make it elected also, I think, really misunderstands the role that elections play in a democracy. If the ultimate sovereign authority is delegated on the basis of an election, then other elections are really not necessary. And again, I turn back to the United States, where people often have this impression that elections automatically make things better. So they elect judges. Right. Well, in a republic, judges really should not be elected. Judges are supposed to have they're supposed to be insulated from that process for a very good reason. And it's not that judges don't make mistakes, and we wish sometime that we could get rid of certain incompetent judges with an election. It's that the idea is that they shouldn't be making judicial decisions on the basis of electoral popularity.
Right.
And yet they do. And we find often in states that sometimes these very small, these offices like mosquito control commissioner is elected. And, you know, does an election actually pick the best person for this kind of highly specialized job? But people just believe that elections automatically make things better. And I think one of my points is no, elections don't automatically make things better. And I call this, I have a rather snarky term for this, I call it the Cool Whip effect. Okay. There used to be these commercials for Cool Whip topping that said that everything's better with Cool Whip.
Right.
So all you have to do is take this dessert and just put a big dollop of Cool Whip and it's automatically better. I said, that's what elections are like. They're like Cool Whip. Because Cool Whip does not necessarily make a really fine intricate dessert better just because you've put it on there. Nothing against Cool Whip. I think it's a great product. The same thing is true. Just making something elected does not automatically improve it. And so I think one of my objections is that people don't really think through. There is this impression that elections automatically confer accountability and legitimacy, and people don't think through the other consequences of election. Appointment, I think, is absolutely fine for a chamber that is not intended ultimately to have the final say. And I think that's the big point there.
I think one of the things that people say when they talk about having an elected Senate is that thing of accountability, that sure, with people like judges or even sheriffs, an electoral accountability probably isn't the best way to go. But when people are dealing with legislation, don't you want some form of accountability, especially if part of what they're doing is responding to what the public wants when they're objecting to a bill?
Well, that's where the suspensive veto becomes important. I think you're right. Elections make more sense in an upper chamber that has an absolute authority to veto. But if it has a suspensive veto, mm-hmm. then the elected house says, we want to do this. The upper chamber says, are you sure? You know, it's sort of almost like talking to a two-year-old. Sure, you want to think about this again? You send it back, and the lower chamber says, yes, we do, and we're the people's chamber. Then the upper house says, okay, fine.
Right.
You know, so their role is not to oppose. And I think election confers this idea that, you know, and the idea of accountability in that sense is that you should be accountable to the same people, and yet you're obviously creating a different constituency. And again, that's fine in a republic. You want to do that in a republic. Republics establish tension among different constituencies that make it difficult and require consensus. But a parliamentary system is designed to be efficient. Mm. It's designed to, you know, for responsible government. And if you don't like that, great, but what you need to do is change the entire system of government. Because if you're just going to change that one component of it, what you're really doing is creating a potential for really undermining the system itself without offering a good alternative.
Right. So do you think then that elections or electoral politics may actually serve to undermine politicians' effectiveness, especially if we go to an elected Senate?
Well, one problem with an elected Senate, as we found with the senators in waiting that have been elected in Alberta, is that one of the goals of an upper house is to provide access to representation for peoples who are not necessarily or represented or are underrepresented in the lower house. And what we find, and there's like one or two exceptions, but for the most part what we find in the electoral experiment that has been occurring in Alberta, which I believe has been recently sort of suspended, is not only are elections expensive, you know, and that's a problem, but that it produces partisan people. The parties become very much involved in the process, which was not something that the Triple E model envisioned, mm-hmm. or at least wanted to sort of tamp down. And the other thing they find is that the people who get elected tend to be middle-aged white men. Right. And often affluent middle-aged white men. Mm-hmm. And so it does nothing really to advance this idea. Where in an appointment process, if it is based on certain expectations, whether formally guided or not, and again, the British House of Lords provides that example, does provide an opportunity, and the Senate has as well, to appoint, say, someone who is a member of the First Nations, or more women, or members of other minority groups who have a much more difficult time getting nominated and elected in the lower house. So that's another consideration for people who want not just accountability, but also want some sort of reflection of the public.
Right, because the Canada I live in is not just white men, mm-hmm. right? So if there's a chance to be more reflective of the way Canada actually is through appointment rather than election, mm-hmm. that would obviously be a point in favor of appointment.
And one of the points I make, and it's anecdotal, but in the British House of Lords, you have had a better track record of appointing people who were from minorities who, you know, I think Lord Pitt, for example, was a black activist, a physician black activist in Britain who was appointed to the House of Lords at a time when there were no black MPs. Mm. And yet here's this man who became a very prominent member of the Lords and spoke for his community very eloquently. You also have people who are able to speak as experts in various fields because they're rewarded for that. And again, a great anecdotal example was Laurence Olivier, who the Labour government at that time deliberately elevated him to the House of Lords in part because they wanted somebody with his expertise to speak on the arts at a time when funding for the arts was a very big issue, who could come to the House of Lords as Lord Olivier, and in these debates, when they were talking about amending legislation relating to the arts, could say, look, you know, I was the director of the National Theatre. I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Here's what I think we should do in amending this legislation.
Right. So he has more authority than some bureaucrat who gets elected.
Upper houses, when they work really well in a parliamentary system, also often become houses of experts.
Right.
In the Canadian case, there was that tendency historically, but it tended to be experts in the areas of business and finance. And that's a little too narrow. And as I think it was Colin Campbell, in his study from the 1960s indicated it could lead to its own kind of corruption, where there became, you know, the senators effectively became lobbyists for certain business interests.
Right.
So you want to be careful about that. But at the same time, it does demonstrate that there is that tendency for upper houses to serve that more specialized role.
Mm-hmm. And there's that old saying, too, that I love, that there's no statutes to committees. Right? It's always to individuals or small groups of people. And if you have experts who are that more individual thing, maybe you can get more done than having large swaths of elected people who don't have that specialized knowledge.
And I think that does really benefit the committee system in the Senate, which is a very, as you pointed out, is a very active system.
Mm-hmm.
Senate committees are much more, I think, productive in the way they do their business because they are not as encumbered by party discipline.
Moving forward, I mean, this government, the conservative government, has talked a lot about forming the Senate, hasn't done anything, partly because they want to go to a constitutional change, which you've talked about how that's not really...
Well, they're waiting for the Supreme Court to make its ruling on whether or not the government can do so unilaterally.
Right.
Which seems unlikely, especially given recent rulings by the Supreme Court, seems highly unlikely. This is the problem of predicting the future, but it seems highly unlikely that the Supreme Court will go along with that. They'll probably insist that for something like this, the provinces have to approve it as well.
Right. So what do you think the most likely scenario would be going forward? Is that we sort of just have the status quo?
I think there's going to be non-constitutional change. I think this was, again, the, you know, whether or not you like the specific action that Justin Trudeau took, he was actually showing that it's possible to do non-constitutional reform in the Senate. And I know that there are senators who have really responded to that idea, and I know that the Senate is in the process of deliberating its own change in non-constitutional ways. I think that's more likely to be the future. The Senate will reform itself from within.
And do you think that will help the public relations effort of the Senate? Because I think it needs to, its image nearly needs to be rebuilt in the minds of a lot of Canadians.
I hope it does. I think the other thing that will help its image is if we do things, again, non-constitutionally, to change the appointment system.
Mm.
If we make the appointment system less overtly partisan, if we have a process in place that provides for input from the opposition parties and input from the public and provides an oversight committee to vet appointees, I think that could go a long way toward improving the image of individual senators and thus of the body as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of that too might be senators being a little more visible as individuals? Because I don't really know who a lot of the senators are. It's not like they come out and speak a lot, or at least in a real public form. Maybe they do smaller stuff locally, but...
Well, that's a good idea. That could help. I mean, we could also say the same things about a lot of MPs.
Right,
The backbenchers, we don't know who they are either. And we're less likely to know who they are because when they do speak, it's really simply to echo the party line. And their message is understandably closely controlled. And some senators have become more obvious and more vocal. A good example being... Sorry, I can't think of his name right now. He edited a book on Senate reform. A senator from Quebec, who I know very well, and I can't think of his name right now. But there are senators who are very actively involved and have been relatively prominent. And so, I think more of that would be helpful. And that might be one of the internal reforms that the Senate pursues, is encouraging its members to become more active in public discourse.
And so, sort of, I think that's almost like, to a certain extent, kind of like the Governor General, whereas he is active, and especially someone like Michael Jean was very active going around and being public and showing people, this is what I do, this is why I'm here, and trying to promote what she was doing. And I think the Senate needs to do that a little bit more.
Well, I think the Senate does try to do that with as you mentioned, it has a lot of public hearings.
Right.
I think if the Senate does more of that and does more to make those part of it is also publicity.
Uh-huh.
The media is more likely to follow around the Governor General than it is to follow a Senate committee.
Sure.
But maybe the Senate can do things to raise its visibility when it does do these issues.
I wonder even if they sit maybe for 2 weeks when the Commons is out. And maybe someone like Evan Solomon and those guys sort of swing by the Senate more often. Something like I think there needs to be something there that they need to do a little different.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and I may steal that for my book.
Okay.
as one of the possibilities for non-constitutional reform.
I like it. So But I think, and I would agree, and I think you would agree, that abolishing the Senate is not a good idea. Like, we need that upper house.
It wouldn't be the end of the world, but no. I think it would be a loss for the improvements to legislation and policy that the Senate does provide.
Right.
And provides really at a bargain. People look at the salary of a senator and they say, wow, that's a lot more than I make. But when you put it into the context of government expenditure, the kinds of improvements that they do to legislation would have to be done by someone else. And if they're done by civil servants, you can actually make an argument that it's more cost-effective to have the Senate do it than to have civil servants do it.
Right. So all in all, it serves a purpose. It just needs to be
And it's a less dramatic purpose. And I think that's the other thing. When people talk about an effective Senate, they're thinking of a Senate that's very dramatic and in the face of the government. And that's not what the upper house has evolved to be. And I think people have to sort of get away from that notion as well.
Mm-hmm. So more maybe a little paternalistic in a sense.
I wouldn't use the word paternalistic. Okay. I would say, again, well, that classic phrase, the chamber of sober second thought. The one that sort of, you know, cleans up the legislation afterward.
Right. I like it. So if people want to find your stuff, what's the best way to find you and some of your work?
Well, if you'd like to find an article, a scholarly article that I wrote on this subject, you go to the occasional paper series of the Association for Canadian Studies in the United States. You can find them online. If you go to it, it's called accessacsus.org. If you go to that website and look down on publications, you'll find the occasional series, and you will find the issue in which, you know, you can easily find where my writing on Senate, which is really a microcosm of the book that I'm completing right now, can be found. And you can also just sort of Google me and find me at whichever institution I happen to be in at the moment.
If you Google the Ottawa Citizen article, comes up as well. If you put that in, the op-ed that you wrote, well, to give a little more context into your thoughts and on the Senate and Senate reform and how to have a more effective Senate, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You know, when you say effective, ask the question: what does it mean to be effective? Does it mean to be, you know, to be improving, or does it mean to be opposing?
Right.
Triple E effective was more about opposing.
Mm.
I think Senate reform has increasingly been moved towards something more modest, but I think more helpful.
Mm. Mm. So, yeah, again, just making things more...
It complements the role of the government and the lower house.
Yeah, have the two houses really work together for the Canadian people and create the best legislation that's possible. So that's a very altruistic way to look at things, and hopefully, maybe one day we'll get there.
Well, and it helps to look at it from the outside. As an American, I don't have a stake in the outcome of it, so I can, you know, then look at it from a theoretical perspective, from a comparative perspective, and so that really does inform my opinions.
Right.
So that can be a helpful way to look at it as well.
Yeah. So being here in Ottawa hasn't corrupted you. You're still able to have that distant view of it.
Oh yes.
Okay. And how much longer are you here?
Not much longer.
No, just the end of this semester or end of the summer?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm still officially a Fulbright chair through the summer, but I'll be more active at a distance.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I appreciate you doing this. It's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome. I appreciate being able to do it.
Oh, good. So that's James McHugh from Akron University, the 2014 Fulbright Visiting Research Chair in North American Integration here at Carleton. If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, HistorySlam@gmail.com. On Twitter, I'm at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.